Actually, Jeff left us at breakfast, so we're just going to start without him. Before we have the first speaker, I have one announcement that I've been handed. There's been an award in the Capture the Flag contest, the first one. It was an IREX box, and the team, if I can read this, is Ross and Lubick of Team SNI. So that's the first winner, and I assume this will continue as per whatever the rule might or might not be. First speaker is Richard Thiem, who was here last year, and I enjoyed listening to him, so I'm going to be staying. He's standing over there, and actually I have no clue what he's going to be talking about, which should make more interesting. And you have a microphone, so you don't have to scream, so come up and thank you all.
Thank you, Bruce. All right, I got a much of my use words like honor, privilege, and respect. You know, it's an honor and a privilege to be introduced by somebody you respect. And I want to begin by just acknowledging why it is we come here. We'll get things back on track. I mean, we always start a little late. Things always work, if you haven't been here before. It always works. And I've had more conversations this time than ever about why did we come back. Some of us look older. And we come back because we don't have to explain anything to anybody here. Somebody just asked me, I said if I could live in this space that DEFCON creates, I would live here. Always. And we try to replicate it online and in our lives when we leave here. Because why we come back is we have presuppositions about how the world works and about what's emerging on the edges of our lives. And we want to leverage the power that our understanding gives us. But we want to do it the way that works. And nobody wants to go down. But we also do want to live unconventionally. And we want to color outside the lines a little bit. We want to cross the borders and boundaries, whatever their impediments to what we want to know. It's just who we are. We want to know. And that's what defines hackers more than any other thing. And what I want to do today, to the degree that I can, is just inject a little energy into the day. I mean, some of you are not in bed yet. Some of you are just getting up. Either end of the bell curve. I want to provide a little energy to just kind of give a little lift to what it is that's going to happen in the next couple of days for some of us and why this is so valuable. There is so much wisdom. I mean, start with a guy like Bruce Schneier or Ian or Mudge or Yobi or any of the guys that hang out here. There is so much wisdom and intelligence and experience and history here. And for people who are coming here, in order to learn from them, there is no better network, there is no better community in which to learn. But in order to do it, we do have to distinguish appearance from reality. Because what we want to learn about is reality and how real power is exercised in a world that is full of simulations and illusions, many of which we create. And we want to do it in a way that sustains and generates the power rush that you all know, that we get from knowing something and knowing how to leverage it in a way that creates a perceived or real advantage. The world has changed profoundly since the first DEFCON. What has changed maybe more than anything is that the consequences of doing this wrong are greater than they were. Because hacking emerged decades ago as a way to play. And the people who learned to play were playing in a new environment that was profoundly attractive, a digital world of almost pure information. And in a world of pure information, your intention, your word, is law. Now you look at the history of social movements, the whole human potential movement that began in this country in the 60s and 70s did not exist before because the world in which it made sense did not exist. You hear a lot about you can create whatever you want to create. That wasn't true ever before because society defined us and defined our role in ways that were much less flexible. But in a world of pure information, what shows up is 100% a function of your intentionality. And therefore, your life becomes and reflects back to you 100% your intentionality. And how you choose to manifest your power is going to have more to do with it than any other single thing. I got a call not long ago from a young guy, he's called a hacker, I guess he works in another country, and his job is breaking the bank. He does this, as many of you know, with the full support and oversight of the government and the banks into which he breaks in order to test their capacity to defend themselves, which at the outset is never very great. And he's doing this with all integrity. He calls young guys, by my standards, I'm a middle-aged male, if you haven't noticed. And he was very, very excited because he's young and he was just offered a job that promised him more money than he ever had before in his life and a great house in which to live. And above all, he said, my hands have more computing power than I ever dreamed I could touch. And I said, what is it you have to do to get all this? He said, all I have to do is become a full-time spy for the government of the country in which I am currently working. And as a dual national, he had that option. And I asked him what he was going to do. And he thought about it, and he said, well, you know, if I ever do come back to the United States, it could cause problems if I have engaged in full-scale espionage against our government. And so I don't think I'm going to take the job. And why should he, when his own government will offer him the same job? So the point is, it is not his behavior, it is not his action, it is not what he knows how to do that constitutes a threat, it is his perceived allegiance. And in the digital world, the construction of reality, which is our business and our livelihood, makes it very difficult to know to whom we are ultimately loyal or what is the ultimate destination of the information we provide. So you have to understand how digital appearances that we manipulate create the construction of reality for somebody else. At this con, I have seen more media presence than at any other con. And if I see a crowd gathered around, I know for sure there's going to be a big camera on somebody's shoulder, a microphone, a light, and somebody taking notes. And the Heisenberg principle is in operation, that whatever it is that the media thereby observes in that process is falsified by the fact of observation. Because the fact of the interview means that the interview will provide information that is at the topmost level of reality and designed to social engineer the media. Because we use one another in a mutually exploitive and mutually valuable sort of way. And it helps to understand that. That's the top level. But the truth of our work is that at the level of the infrastructure, the people who build the infrastructure design the possibility of the question that can be asked, because no one else even sees what those questions are. Matt Blaze, cryptographer, and find his notes I took on the statements he made at Computers, Freedom, and Privacy. Matt Blaze said this, talking about the critical security path. Anything that is in the critical security path is potentially the weakest link in the system, including the definition of the problem. The definition of the problem, as seen by the implementers, and the real definition of the problem are often not the same thing. In other words, the problem as it is defined, the model of reality, the paradigm, if you will, determines the questions that people are capable of asking. And when you enter into the mass media as a livelihood, there are four stages of socialization through which you go. The first is you see an incredible story in which you uncover some profound reality that conflicts with the consensus reality of the society in which you live. And so you do the work. You do what Gary Webb did in San Jose on the CIA-Contra drug connection. You do the work to get the story. And then you take it back to your editor. And the editor says, we don't cover that kind of story. Okay, so that's stage one. The next time you stumble across something that profoundly chills you in the depths of your being, you start to cover it, but you remember and you wait and you go to the editor first and you tell him what you want to cover or her, and the editor says, we don't do that kind of story. And then the third stage of socialization is when you see the events happening, but you don't go to the editor anymore and you just think, we don't do that kind of story. And then the fourth stage is when the events are right in front of your face and you don't even see them anymore because you have been so profoundly socialized to not see what isn't going to be validated as the consensus reality. And so I heard a reporter say to a number of young people sitting around, so what is your definition of a hacker? And of course, everybody had a definition, and finally somebody said, you know, why don't you decide? And the member of the media said, it's up to us to decide? Okay. And that okay that popped out so lightly and effortlessly is the bigger truth written large in our social consciousness. It's up to them to decide, and they must filter everything they see and hear in order to create a module of meaning that interfaces with the construction of reality of the lowest common denominator of the society in which we live. Because people have told me that the very brightest, i.e. the front page of the Wall Street Journal, aims its literacy level at ninth grade, and that is considered profoundly high. Everything else, depending on where it's aimed, is much lower. And so understand at the outset that this is a media that will reflect you as an image for people for whom you are profoundly fascinating and frightening. When the Cold War ended, spies disappeared from our imagination as great figures of divided loyalty because the big archetypal mythological context in which East-West spying happened suddenly vanished, and we no longer had that romanticization as an option. So spies, good spy novels, that's the thing I did most about the end of the Cold War. It was a great book. But hackers, not accidentally, have emerged to replace spies in the popular imagination. Why? For the same reason that spies were fascinating, because spies are allowed to break the rules, but, like my friend said, who called, sanctioned by the government to determine the rules, to break the rules, and that's what everybody in their larcenous hearts really wants to do. But because you have also internalized that you can't do it, you also hate those who get away with it and want to see them punished. And so you are fascinated by them, gather around them, read about them, love hearing about what they do, and relish learning of how long Kevin Mitnick is languishing in jail. And yet, the consequences, as I said, in 6 years, have profoundly shifted. People who are actively being co-opted, whether they know it or not, useful idiots or active agents, in order to engage in intrusion in critical infrastructure of this country, are putting themselves at incredible risk. Because it isn't the intrusion that is the threat. It's not the kid that can be caught that's the threat. It's not the kid whose ego makes him visible like a deer in the forest that moves by telling someone else that is the threat. It is the self-invasion of the system and depositing time-certain bombs that will explode when detonated, and the relationship of that explosion is to a strategic plan not to bring down the infrastructure, which is secondary in power and reward, but to do it at a time that leverages the geopolitical advantage of the people who have done it in the first place. So, in the old days when hacking emerged, it was not breaking the law, because there was no law that defined the people who played on the bigger systems at MIT when they start enjoying themselves by exploring the network and how it works. That network, which is now ubiquitous in the world, has created hackers as fish on the reef in the niche that no one else can fill. But the law is trying to catch up, and so it pays to notice what the law is trying to say and simply make choices. You can make two kinds of mistakes in life. Those that fuck you up forever and those from which you learn and grow. And it is trying to avoid the first kind that our lives are really about. So, privacy is dead. The system is in a process of becoming conscious of itself. Dominique said at Black Hat Briefing, it takes a long time for the collective consciousness to understand the system. And what is happening is the collective system, the symbiotic consciousness created by the global ubiquitous network, is in process of becoming conscious of itself. And those of you who are best and brightest are on the cutting edge of that growing awareness. And it is on the edge that new emergent realities show up for the first time and need people to give them names. And Robert Galvin built Motorola through its great years, looked back at all the decisions that it worked as that company became great. And he said, you know, every single idea that resulted in a profound breakthrough and shifted the paradigm or model of reality according to which we lived and worked began its life as a minority opinion. It was heard first way on the edge, and it was ridiculed if it was heard at all. It was dismissed. It was discounted. And finally, as it migrated toward the center, in the world of radical transition, the edge is constantly becoming the new center. Finally, it became the center of a new consensus reality, and everyone agreed that they had always thought that way all the time. That's the way it happened. 1967, J.C.R. Linklater, a psychologist, told a group of brilliant scientists that he had a vision of a day when computers would connect to one another and communicate with one another, and so could the human beings connected as nodules to them. And those brilliant scientists rolled their eyes in disgust and disbelief and made shuffling motions in the back of the room to indicate their disgust and contempt for someone even suggest such an outlandish thing. 10 years later, Bob Noyce, one of the founders of Intel, held up a chip for the people of IBM. And he said to them, what are you going to do when we're building computers around these chips? And because it was a question that didn't fit the old model, there was absolute silence until someone rejected it from the rear by saying, I guess IBM will just have to fold. And everybody roared with laughter. And so they came very, very close to doing that. So, no, that George Bernard Shaw was right. All great truth begins as blasphemy. All great truth begins as blasphemy, and hacking began as the exploration of the emergent reality, the digital construction of reality, in which everybody is coming to live and move and have their being. And so knowing how to make those modules and manipulate them and build the infrastructure so that the questions people can ask that they don't even know they are able to ask are yours to create. This is your charge. So, this is no joke. You know, here's a couple of quotes that make sense to me. Nick Machiavelli was in the same boat in the Renaissance, facing a new order of things, and he said, there is nothing more difficult to take in, nor more perilous to conduct, or more uncertain in its success than to take the lead in the new order of things. And that, whether you want it or not, is your destiny. It is in your hand to leverage your power. And how do you do it? Rogue Agent said this in a post that he gave me permission to. You want to create hackers? He said to someone who was trying to write a simple, easy book, making hacking happy. You want to create hackers? He said. Don't tell them how to do this or that, because of course you undermine then their capacity to learn for themselves. If you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him or her, because the Buddha is trying to put himself in the way of your own actualization and growth. Show them instead, he said, how to discover for themselves. Those who have the drive will get the point. They'll find the experts and will learn from them. Or better yet, simply dive in and learn by trial and error. And that's where knowing what kind of mistakes you're permitted to make and those you aren't is critical. Those who don't fall by the wayside. I never learned half so much taught by others as when I taught myself. It's worth the extra time and effort. He concluded, of course, give me a fish and I'll eat for a day, give me a pole and teach me how to fish and I'll eat for the rest of my life. The wisdom that is available in this conference from those who have gone before and learned what works and doesn't work is available. And that is the wisdom, the connection, the network, the knowing what to do and what not to do. If you do the homework and show up first, then you can get it. Because then you're going to be able to function in the world that's emerging in the next century. What kind of world? My favorite quote from the Chinese Army newspaper. The middle-level officers in their 30s write this, looking ahead 30 years to when they believe China will be ascendant and the United States of America, if such a thing continues to exist, will be less than ascendant because all things turn in time. Twice as many people speak Chinese in the world as speak what we call the universal language, English. And one of the officers wrote, after the Gulf War, when everyone was looking forward to universal peace, in fact, a new military revolution emerged. It's a transformation from mechanized warfare of the industrial age to the information warfare of the information age. It's a war of decisions and control. A war of knowledge, a war of intellect. The aim of information warfare
is being changed from preserving yourself and wiping out the opponent to preserving yourself and controlling the opponent. It includes electronic warfare, tactical deception, strategic deterrence, propaganda warfare, psychological warfare, network warfare, and structural sabotage. Of course, it is not new that this is what people are trying to do. I have a friend who worked in the CIA who was there in Angola when the Cubans were there. He said, we stopped all the black ops because it was a waste of time. We just sat around trying to dream up stuff that we could say the Cubans had done, and then inventing the pictures and text that we seeded from the 200 selected journalists in the world that did our bidding in order to create the construction of consensus reality that said this is who the Cubans are and what they do. And people immediately project onto those images all of the potency and power that the images themselves, constructed from nothing, do not have. My favorite was a picture of a Cuban soldier standing snarling ferociously over a woman who had just been raped, lying in the roadside. Both people were real, except that the soldier was in Angola and the woman was in another country altogether. He was very proud of that one. So this is not new that people do this. When we were in Somalia, you know, we're the greatest superpower in the world. The greatest superpower in the world had its will broken. When a videotape of two rangers who had been killed were shown being dragged behind a jeep. 30-second video clip was all it took, real or not, to break the will of the only superpower in the world, controlling the opponent without firing a shot. You're considered a third generation, a third level, fourth level warlord leading a faction in a backward country. 30-second video can break the will of the greatest power. Soft destruction. So the question to ask yourselves through the conflict, but also more deeply than that, is what is your intention? Because in a world of pure information, your intention is everything. Yes, you want to know. We want to know everything. I have sometimes, I'm sure you have too, stumbled on things in the middle of the night that you don't want to know. You have seen documents or images scroll on the screen. You have suddenly had a window break, and you have seen clearly what is really the blood on our own hands, or what is happening in the world. The end result of hacking the old Milnet for some, to suddenly see who we are and what we do. What do you do in that moment? I wrote a piece called Hacking Chinatown on my website. What do you do in those Chinatown moments in which you suddenly realize that things are never what they seem in Chinatown? And you have broken through the images of the consensus reality. To what end are you hacking? To hack the infrastructure is one thing, to learn how it works, to learn how to manipulate it, to get a power rush when you shut someone down or pull off a great joke. Breaking and entering. But if that's where it begins and ends for you, it's going to end with breaking and entering. It's too easy to catch people who leave tracks in cyberspace these days. You have to work collectively and you have to work very, very smart to pull off what used to be simple, easy, unidentifiable hacks. So it's best not to do the dumb stuff because you're too smart for that. But that still is the big stuff to do. So what kind of future do you want to create out of that intentionality? The ancient wisdom of hacking begins with seeing what is not there. It begins with seeing at the emergent line, like the Terminator on the moon, liminal vision. It begins with what is missing from the big picture that everyone else sees. It consists of seeing the whole modular construction so that you can engage from a position of power with those who don't. A guy was at the school system in his high school, turned over to him by the technology guy in his high school. I talked to the technology guy. Loved the guy. He called up with me and said, are you aware that there are websites where you can get tools for entering websites? He's the head of technology for the major school. The major high school in my state is considered one of the best in the country. The head of technology. So he had this kid, he said, to help him. And this is what the kid told. He said, I kept trying to show him how the system worked. But he kept asking me questions and told me he just didn't get it. Because if he was teachable, he would have come to ask different questions. So in order to continue to be the administrator, I told him just what he needed to know to fit the construction of modular reality that he had in his head to satisfy him and alleviate his anxiety because then he would close the circle incorrectly and walk away content. And I could continue to control the system and play away. In order to do that, then he had to see everything he could see and the smaller view of reality that the head of technology in that school could see. The higher up your view of the system, the greater your freedom to choose the modular interface with which you will interact, both online and off, in order to make sense for people lower down in their construction of reality. If you can see everything, then you can relate to all of it where it is. See, what we're talking about is the way the world is learning how to think as a complex interactive system. Minsky at MIT said, "What do we mean by thinking?" he asked. By thinking, we mean the capacity to hold simultaneously in your mind alternative constructions of reality that are often contradictory and paradoxical, and the sort of system in relationship to the data that it continues to stream into your life in order to approximate a good enough fit for now to be functional. He said that's what we mean by thinking. And therefore, we could say of people who can only construct reality one way that literally they are not capable of thinking. And we know when we engage in dialogue, so-called, with people who have a fixed and rigid fundamentalist or literalist view of any domain of knowledge, that there is no conversation, because all they can see is the thing that they can see. And there, therefore, is no exchange or give or take or dialogue. He said it is as critical to life today to know how to interact with that network in powerful and profound ways as it was in ancient days to know how to speak. Because we came to say if you could not speak the language of your tribe, you were not fully human. And he is saying that where thinking is happening in the global system today and increasingly the interplanetary system, is on the net, so style, the big net, the interaction of all the systems that interact. And if you do not connect with that, then you will be left behind in the definition of humanity. So what I'm suggesting is that you have to begin as a novice, turning back to my definition as a rule-based person. You hear a lot about the rules out there in society. Novices, beginners, always start with the rules. In the stages of development of expertise, you begin with context-free rules. Do this, do that, program this way. This is the way C++ works. This is the way Unix works. Do the following thing. Obey the rules and don't break the rules until you achieve an intermediate level of expertise where you begin to have enough of a database of experiential knowledge to reference as you begin to see how the rules don't always apply in certain spots. When you become truly expert, you break the rules all the time. Which is why old-style knowledge systems, AI systems, expert systems that tried to use brute force rule-based attacks didn't work because human beings who are experts break the rules, but they know when to break the rules. They know when to break the rules because they're accessing meta-rules that transcend the rules by which beginners live. And so it's a question not only of programming or interacting with the system, but of life. You begin by following the rules. Where's puppies can download anything they want and apply brute force attack in a simple, simplistic way. But that's the beginning. That's what beginners do. This is where the Zen master sends you back to the net and tells you to keep playing with the rules until you begin to learn how the rules themselves emerge and why they work and why they don't work. When you come away finally saying, I think the way Linux thinks, you know, if you understand Unix, you understand the Unix. Unix describes the Unix. And if you understand Windows NT,